Dr. Scott is Professor Emeritus of English at the University of California, Berkeley. He is author of Drugs, Oil, and War, and seven other books, including Deep Politics and the Death of JFK and the Iran-Contra Connection. He has also published award-winning poetry. Both his prose and poetry deal, among other matters, with U.S. covert operations, their impact on democracy at home and abroad, their relations to the John F. Kennedy assassination, and their relations to the global drug traffic. Dr. Scott holds degrees from McGill University, his city of birth. Prior to having taught for 34 years at UC Berkeley, Scott was a Canadian diplomat and served at the United Nations in the Canadian Embassy in Poland. Dr. Scott.
The American people have been seriously misled about the origins of Al-Qaeda, a movement blamed for the 9/11 attacks, just as they have been seriously misled about the reasons for America's invasion of Iraq. The truth is that for at least two decades, the United States has engaged in energetic programs to secure U.S. control over the Persian Gulf, and also to open up Central Asia for development by U.S. oil companies. Americans were eager to gain access to the petroleum reserves of the Caspian Basin, which at that time were still estimated to be the largest known reserves of unexploited fuel in the planet. To this end, time after time, U.S. covert operations in the region have used so-called Arab-Afghan warriors as assets. The jihadis, whom we loosely link with the name and leadership of Al-Qaeda. In country after country, these Arab Afghans have been involved in trafficking Afghan heroin. America's sponsorship of drug trafficking Muslim warriors, including those now in Al-Qaeda, dates back to the Afghan War of 1979-89, sponsored in part by the CIA's links to the drug laundering Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI. It was part of CIA Director Casey's strategy for launching covert operations over and above those approved and financed by a democratically controlled Congress. The most conspicuous example of this alliance with drug traffickers in the 1980s was the Contra support operation. Here again, foreign money and drug profits filled the gap after Congress denied funds through the so-called Boland Amendments. In this case, government funds were also used to lie about the Contras to the American people. And I will add, apropos of this morning, that there was also a massive cover-up, including a cover-up of people, some of them convicted, who are now in the present administration. And my book, Covert Politics, talks about the role of Lee Hamilton in that cover-up. The lying continues. The 9/11 Commission report assures Americans that, quote, Bin Laden and his comrades had their own sources of support and training, and they received little or no assistance from the United States, close quote. This misleading statement fails to consider that, one, Al-Qaeda elements received considerable indirect U.S. government assistance, first in Afghanistan till 92, and thereafter in other countries such as Azerbaijan, 92 to 95, and Kosovo, 1998. Before 1992, for example, the Afghan leader Jalaluddin Haqqani organized and hosted the Arab-Afghan volunteers known later as Al-Qaeda, and in turn, Haqqani, quote, received bags of money each month from the CIA station in Islamabad, close quote. The Arab Afghans were also trained in urban terrorism, including car bombings, by Pakistani ISI operatives who in turn were trained by the CIA. Two, key members of the network, which became Al-Qaeda, such as Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman Ali Mohammed, Mohammed Jamal Khalifa, and perhaps Ayman al-Zawahiri were granted visas to enter the United States, despite being suspected of terrorism and, in some cases, on State Department watch lists. Al-Qaeda foot soldiers were also admitted to the United States for training under a special visa program. 3. An Al-Qaeda operative at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, an Al-Qaeda operative was given a list of Muslim candidates for Al-Qaeda's jihad. 4. When Al-Qaeda personnel were trained in the United States by a key Al-Qaeda operative, Sergeant Ali Mohammed of the U.S. Army Special Forces, Mohammed was still on the U.S. Army payroll. 5. As we know, there was FBI protection of Al-Qaeda terrorists from investigation and prosecution, the case of Mousawi that we heard about this morning being just one. In part, America's limited covert assistance to Al-Qaeda after 1989 was in order not to offend Al-Qaeda's primary source supporters, which America needed as allies, the intelligence networks of Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. But unquestionably, the entry of United States oil companies into oil-rich Azerbaijan was achieved with the assistance of a U.S.-organized covert program using Arab-Afghan operatives associated with bin Laden. Oil was the driving force of U.S. involvement in Central and South Asia, and oil led to U.S. coexistence with both Al-Qaeda and the world-dominating Afghan heroin trade. This brings us to another extraordinary distortion in the 9/11 report. While the drug trade was a source of income for the Taliban, it did not serve the same purpose for Al-Qaeda. Now, that drug trafficking does support Al-Qaeda-connected operations has been energetically asserted by the governments of Great Britain and many other European countries, as well as the head of the U.S. Congressional Task Force on Terrorism. Heroin trafficking has been a source of income, in particular, for Al-Qaeda-related warriors in Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, Chechnya, and Kosovo. Most recently, it has supported terrorist attacks in the Netherlands and Spain. U.S. support for Al-Qaeda elements, particularly in Azerbaijan and Kosovo, has increased dramatically the flow of drugs to the West and also to this country. In the former Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan, Arab Afghans clearly assisted the effort of U.S. oil companies to penetrate the region. In 1992, Richard Secord, Heini Eiderholt, and Ed Dearborn, three veterans of U.S. operations in Laos and then Iran-Contra, turned up in Baku under the cover of an oil company, Mega Oil. Now, Mega never did find oil, but it did contribute materially to the removal of Azerbaijan from the sphere of post-Soviet Russian influence. As mega operatives in Azerbaijan, Secord, Adderholt, and Dearborn and their men engaged in military training. They passed brown bags filled with cash to members of the government, and above all, set up an airline on the model of Air America, which was soon picking up hundreds of Mujahideen mercenaries in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Mujahideen leader Gulbuddin Hekmatyar in Afghanistan, who at the time was still allied with bin Laden, was, quote, observed recruiting Afghan mercenaries, that's to say Arab Afghans, Al-Qaeda, to fight in Azerbaijan against Armenia and its Russian allies, close quote. In this period, Hekmatyar's heroin surged through Baku into Chechnya and Russia and North America. It is difficult to believe that Dearborn's airline, much like Air America, was not involved. The triple pattern of drugs, oil, and Al-Qaeda was seen again in Kosovo in 1998, where the Al-Qaeda-backed Islamist jihadis of the Kosovo Liberation Army, KLA, received overt American assistance from the U.S. government. Though unmentioned in mainstream books on the war, both the Al-Qaeda and the drug backgrounds of the KLA are recognized by experts and, to my knowledge, have never been contested by them. At the time, critics charged that U.S. oil interests were interested in building a trans-Balkan pipeline with U.S. Army protection. Although initially ridiculed, these critics were eventually proven correct. BBC News announced in December 2004 that a $1.2 billion pipeline south of a huge new U.S. Army base in Kosovo has been given a go-ahead by the governments of Albania, Bulgaria, and Macedonia. Meanwhile, by 2000, according to DEA statistics, Afghan heroin accounted for almost 20% of the heroin seized in the United States, nearly double the percentage taken 4 years earlier. Much of it is now distributed here by Kosovar Albanians. Now I'd like to talk a bit about Sergeant Ali Mohammed, and I'm only sorry I don't have enough time to do justice to this subject. The 9/11 report describes Ali Mohammed as, quote, a former Egyptian army officer who had moved to the United States in the mid-1980s, enlisted in the U.S. Army, and become an instructor at Fort Bragg, as well as helping to plan the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Kenya. In fact, Ali Mohammed was a very important Al-Qaeda agent who, as the 9/11 Commission was told, quote, trained most of the Al-Qaeda's top leadership, including persons who would later carry out the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, close quote. But the person telling the 9/11 Commission this, U.S. Attorney Patrick J. Fitzgerald, very much in the papers these days, misrepresented Ali Mohammed's FBI relationship. He told the commission that, quote, from 1994 until his arrest in 1998, Mohammed lived as an American citizen in California, applying for jobs as an FBI translator and working as a security guard for a defense contractor. Now, Ali Mohammed was not just an FBI job applicant. Unquestionably, he was an FBI informant, and almost certainly he was something more than this. A veteran of the CIA-trained bodyguards of Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, he was able, despite being on a State Department watch list, to come to America around 1984 on what an FBI consultant has called, quote, a visa program controlled by the CIA, close quote, and to obtain a job, first as a security officer, then with U.S. Special Forces. In 1998, he took a lengthy leave of absence from the U.S. Army and went to fight in Afghanistan, totally against U.S. Army regulations. And there, he met with Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was later bin Laden's chief deputy in al-Qaeda, and the rest of the Arab-Afghan leadership. Despite this breach of regulations, he was able to receive an honorable discharge 1 year later, at which point he established close contact with bin Laden in Afghanistan. Now, Ali Mohammed clearly enjoyed U.S. protection. In 1993, he was detained by the RCMP in Canada, and a single phone call to the United States secured his release. This enabled him to play a role in the same year in planning the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Kenya in 1998. Now, eventually, he was allowed to plea bargain and receive a secret sentence. We don't know what the sentence is, still not known as late as 1991, where he's continuing to talk to the press. The amazing thing, although that he was named as a conspirator in that bombing, he was not an indicted conspirator, which itself is evidence of something going on behind the scene. Congress should determine the true relationship of the U.S. government to Ali Mohammed, who was close to bin Laden and above all Zawahiri, who has been called the main player in 9/11. This is very important, I think, that whereas the report focuses almost uniquely on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib, many other sources independently say the main figure and the top brains in al-Qaeda was al-Zawahiri, who Ali Mohammed was clearly close to. I didn't put it in my remarks, but he brought Zawahiri twice to this country to raise funds, ostensibly for charities, but were funds that were used, in fact, for covert operations. So this was our U.S. insight into the top level of the Arab Afghans and of al-Qaeda. In particular, Congress should determine why Patrick Fitzgerald chose to mislead the American people about Mohammed's FBI status. In short, the al-Qaeda terror network accused of the 9/11 attacks was supported and expanded by U.S. programs and covert operations, both during and, most importantly, after the Soviet-Afghan War. So Congress should rethink their decision to grant still greater powers and budget to the agencies responsible for fostering this enemy in the first place. Sane voices clamor from the Muslim world that the best answer to terrorism is not war, but justice. We should listen to them. By using its energies to reduce the injustices tormenting Islam, the United States will do more to diminish terrorism than by creating any number of new directorates in Washington. Thank you.
This is absolutely riveting testimony. Absolutely riveting. Thank you. Nafis.
Thank you. I'm very glad, actually, that Peter, you brought up this kind of information, because this is the core of my new research. And that's what I'll be discussing. I'll be discussing some of these issues of what's been happening in the post-Cold War period. An accurate understanding of the history of U.S. relations with the Afghan Mujahideen is essential to understand international terrorism today. So what I'm going to try and do is attempt to condense this history very, very briefly to capture some of its most striking and significant features. And in doing so, I'm going to hope to demonstrate as fact a hypothesis that flies entirely in the face of the official narrative, that U.S. relations with the Mujahideen selectively did not end with the Cold War, but on the contrary, have continued in many odd ways to this day in the post-Cold War era, and that this subtle hidden relationship contributes quite directly to the systematic undermining of national security through the inadvertent cultivation of the sources of international terrorism. So I won't talk about the formation of al-Qaeda as such. This is not going to be very interesting, since we all know that about the history of al-Qaeda, its formation at the behest of the United States and other Western powers in Afghanistan. What about beyond Afghanistan? Well, it's very interesting, because after the departure of Soviet troops from Afghanistan and the collapse of the Soviet Union in about 1989, the anti-Soviet Afghan factions began competing for power. Although in 1991, the US and the USSR, they formally agreed to jointly cease aiding any faction in Afghanistan. In fact, the Department of State remained anxious about who might emerge as the winner of this competition within Afghanistan amongst the different factions. According to a Swiss TV journalist by the name of Richard Lebivier, in his book Dollars for Terror, European intelligence sources that he cites revealed that the CIA and the Saudis, intent on securing a regime commensurate with their joint regional interests, agreed that they did not want to give up, quote, the assets of a profitable collaboration. Accordingly, in 1991, the CIA, Saudi intelligence, and bin Laden held a series of meetings. Although exactly what was agreed upon remained secret, Lebivier, citing European intelligence sources, reports that the CIA remained determined to maintain some kind of influence in Afghanistan, which is, of course, the vital route to Central Asia, where the great oil companies are preparing, have been preparing, the energy El Dorado for the coming millennium. Labivier's findings are corroborated to some extent by other credible sources. We know for a fact that after the Soviet withdrawal, Osama bin Laden returned for a short period to Saudi Arabia, to tend to the family construction business in Jeddah. But even after 1991, when Saudi security held on to bin Laden's passport, he had considerable influence in Saudi royal circles. He managed to lobby the Saudi royal family to organize civil defense in the kingdom and to raise a force from among the Afghan war veterans to fight Iraq. But the Saudi regime, they turned down his offer. Instead, they accepted the influx of 300,000 US soldiers. Now, according to the journalist Gerald Posner, as we know from NBC Today, this was the key point at which bin Laden decided to become an apparent enemy of the Saudi regime. But in April 1991, according to a classified US intelligence report, then head of Saudi intelligence services, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, struck a secret deal with bin Laden, despite his being under house arrest for his opposition to the presence of US soldiers. Under this deal, although the regime would publicly disown him, bin Laden was permitted to leave Saudi Arabia with his funding and supporters. Moreover, the regime would continue to fund his activities on condition that he does not target the Saudi kingdom himself. Now, Posner's account of a secret agreement between bin Laden and Saudi intelligence is significant because he argues that this was known to US intelligence. This wasn't something that we didn't know. Le Bivier also interviewed a CIA analyst about the role of the Mujahideen. And this CIA agent said, quote, that the policy of guiding the evolution of Islam and of helping them against our adversaries worked marvelously well in Afghanistan against the Red Army. The same doctrines can still be used to destabilize what remains of Russian power, and especially to counter the Chinese influence in Central Asia. Excuse me. So when I read this, I mean, I was quite surprised that could this really be possible? So I thought, how can we test this hypothesis? Why don't we have a look at these key regions, you know, Eastern Europe, the Balkans, Central Asia, and let's see if you can establish that some kind of connection continues to exist between the United States and Al-Qaeda. And as Peter rightly pointed out, we know for a fact that in the Balkans, the United States twice connected themselves with Al-Qaeda. In the first Bosnian War, the Pentagon set up, and this has came up in a number of ways, I suppose the most credible source is the official Dutch inquiry, which produced a Srebrenica report a few years ago, and based on Dutch intelligence sources. The Pentagon was flying in Mujahideen into Bosnia to manipulate the direction of the conflict. To the extent that, I mean, Yusuf Badansky, who was director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism, his outlet said that U.S. Special Forces were actually seen coming off planes with the Mujahideen. So this was a very close kind of coordination. The same kind of policy was implemented in Kosovo, as Peter noted. The KLA and the State Department confirmed in 1998 that the KLA has connections to Al-Qaeda. A man by the name of Ralph Mutschk, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, he's a head of a department in Interpol. He actually testified before Congress in the year 2000, and he confirmed the same thing, that we know for a fact that Al-Qaeda has been funding the KLA. There is an intermovement of people in terms of Mujahideen. There is also movement of drugs and heroin and so on and so forth between these organizations. So there was a clear linkage there. At the same time, we know that before the Kosovo War, I mean, according to sources like the Sunday Times, the United States and Britain got involved and we were training the KLA, the same people who, of course, were mingling with Al-Qaeda. And this is very worrying, because to go back to Badansky has pointed out that the Albanian mafia, which is tightly connected to the KLA, is laundering money, providing technology, safe houses, and other support to terrorists within this country, and of course within the UK. This is what he says. Badansky says, this isn't to say that the Albanians themselves would carry out the actual terrorist operations, but there are undoubtedly sleeper agents within the Albanian networks, and they can rely upon those networks to provide them with support. In any case, a serious investigation of the Albanian mob isn't going to happen because they're our boys, they're protected. Now, this phenomenon didn't just occur in the Balkans. I looked at a number of key regions. I looked at North Africa, and the countries in there I looked at were Algeria and Libya. I also looked at the Asia Pacific, and I looked at the Philippines, and several other. I looked at the Caucasus, I looked at the Russian-Chechen conflict, and I found a very odd pattern. And I'll just to give you an idea, I'll look at North Africa and Algeria. Now, in Algeria, we have a conflict going on, where we have a secular regime which is fighting a kind of a radical minority group, which is affiliated by numerous reports to Al-Qaeda. One of the main organizations, terrorist groups active in Algeria is the GIA, which has spearheaded a campaign in the country. They've slaughtered something like 100,000 civilians. It's very well known, documented by numerous human rights groups. Now, the same group which has carried out these massacres, numerous reports have emerged in the British press. Defectors from the Algerian intelligence services have come out on record, and they've stated that the GIA has been manipulated and penetrated by Algerian intelligence services and is being used to consolidate the regime's power. Now, this would be, I mean, we have a very close relationship to the Algerian regime, the United States, Britain, and Europe. We have very close ties due to the oil and gas there. We have very heavy investments. We also have very close military ties, particularly the French government has very close military ties to the regime. The United States government has been involved with many new military programs with Algeria and so on and so forth. We're very tight with Algeria, and we do not want to damage this relationship. The problem arises when, is there a point where we have, is there any information which suggests that we are aware of the fact that this is going on, apart from the fact this has come out on the public record? Well, interestingly, there was a trial in the UK from which emerged various classified Foreign Office documents. And the trial was actually about the case of some Algerian terrorists or alleged terrorists in the UK. What emerged from these Foreign Office documents was that United States intelligence services and British intelligence services have been aware of this phenomenon for many years. Many reports talk about, there was this reported in the Guardian newspaper, by the way. Many of the reports talked about the British reports saying that we are aware that we believe that the GIA has been manipulated by the Algerian secret services for their own ends. You know, we believe that the Algerian secret services are completely unscrupulous and so on and so forth. U.S. intelligence report was there saying that the 1995 Paris bombings, which were blamed on Algerian militants, the GIA, we believe that probably at least one of the bombs was carried out when ordered by the Algerian secret services. And we do not have any evidence to suggest that the GIA actually carried this out, and so on and so forth. And I found that the same pattern was prevalent in the Philippines, very much similar. We had the Abu Sayyaf, a terrorist organization, which we must emphasize was heavily tied to 9/11. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, was based in the Philippines, a member of Abu Sayyaf. It was in the Philippines that they hatched the Project Boyinca plan, which was the blueprint behind 9/11, as is now well known. It was hatched in 1995. It had two dimensions. One dimension was to blow up 11 airliners or so over the Pacific. Another was to hijack civilian planes and hurl them into key buildings in the United States. Now, the Abu Sayyaf, again, I looked at Philippine sources, Philippine newspapers. I went through the records, and I have a public address from a guy by the name of Senator Pimentel, who is a very prominent legislator in the Philippines. He gave a public address before the Philippine Senate, and he said, I have information that Abu Sayyaf has been handled by Philippine military intelligence. He even named officials who were working in the Philippine military at that time and said, we need to investigate these people. He named one guy by the name of Edwin Angeles, who was supposedly a leader of the Abu Sayyaf, and he said that this man is actually a double agent. He's been an informant for years, and this subsequently came out. It actually emerged. It was a whole scandal in the Philippine press. And again, we have a very close relationship to the Philippine regime. I have a quote from a U.S. major there who was saying that we work here as counterparts. We have co-generals, co-directors. We have one troop for every Philippine troop. We're working very closely on accounting this counter-terrorist offensive against what's happening. So I mean, I don't want to go into detail, but I discussed this
because we don't have time.
Yeah, we don't have time. But suffice to say, in conclusion, that this is a phenomenon I've discovered to be prevalent throughout many regions in the Middle East and Central Asia. It's a very worrying phenomenon. And it fundamentally challenges the whole paradigm of the war on terror. That if we are allying ourselves in some manner with Al-Qaeda in this rather direct way, how can we fight a war and win? It just doesn't make any sense. The first thing we need to do is go to the source of our policy and correct that before we want to fight a war. And I would suggest that we need to look exactly at what we're doing in this respect before we go around invading other countries and saying that we're going to go and solve terrorism through military invasion.
Thank you very much.